Welcome, Daniel, to Writer's Series.
Thank you.
You hail from a background of being a chemical engineer and law. So, how were you introduced to taking interest and contributing to the realm of economics and financial theory?
Well, my work in economics, in chemical engineering and in law involved some amount of economics and certainly a fair amount of financial calculation. And I developed an interest in the subject and read some quite extensively in economic theory and in financial management. And I thought I would could contribute a little something to the literature in the form of the book where I sort of contrast the specificity of my work in chemical engineering with a relatively more human and foible-filled world of economics and finance.
You wrote the book Fiscal Follies, and in there you question whether economics should be considered a science. How did you explore that concept, and what conclusion did you reach?
Well, there is a big difference that's worth exploring in all facets of science. You're very often in encounter equations or model in which you attempt to predict the future using variables. But there's a profound difference in physics and chemistry from the rest of these social sciences and even the biological sciences, because the specificity of the equation is very different. And in chemical engineering, you also ask the question, is the equation any good? Can I justify spending money, shelling out large amounts of capital to commercialize a process? And I need to have a great deal of confidence in the relationship between the variables before I can really justify spending a lot of capital to commercialize the process.
In the book, you've also shared past contributions that you've made in Barron's because you also had a segment, Other Voices, and you mentioned that you decided to share a portion of it that was received well by the audiences. What was special about the articles that were used in Fiscal Follies, and what becomes of the content that has not been repurposed yet?
Well, the articles, some of the articles I wrote for Barron's were quite fun in that I tried to use familiar movie plots and that I could then use to teach principles of economics and show how a movie plot could address a contemporary economic issue. And the editor of Barron's at the time quite enjoyed the working with me to develop these articles, and I thought they were worth republishing because they're not only insightful and they're fun.
You do like to infuse your work with humor and cultural references, not only to educate and entertain your audiences, but when you're writing, how do you entertain yourself?
Well, I approached the topic of economics and finance as a bit of an outsider. I'm not writing to advance a political opinion. I am more interested in whether there's something really quite new I can bring to a subject. I'm not interested in just participating in the usual give and take of what is often a very political discussion around some of these economic issues.
Do you feel that the economists take themselves too seriously out there?
Well, they do. I think it's fair to say they do. And the reason it's useful for someone like me to come in with my background is to illustrate the extent to which the models they use are filled with error. And I also review some of their past mistake when they've told us that something is going to happen and it simply doesn't, or they tell us that a problem will pass away quickly or is transitory and it's not. And these things are more than just blunders. They hint at a profound truth, which is that economics is not really at all the same as physics or chemistry or engineering.
If it were hypothetically a fixed science, do you feel that accountability would be more easily to nail down?
Well, it would be. Certainly, yes. But because economics is bound up with human nature, it will never have the specificity and reproducibility of the hard sciences. I use a couple of examples with the precision of chemistry is facilitated in many cases by the number of data points you have at your disposal. If and I use the example, it's somewhat simple, but the measuring of molecular weights and atomic weights, it's very easy to develop a data set with even a small sample. You will be sampling trillions of atoms that behave relatively predictably. There's no way that economic science will ever have the advantage of very quickly and easily running an experiment where they use trillions of data points.
In your book, you do reference the 2008 financial crisis. Was that a byproduct of a misunderstanding or a mistake that was made by the professionals out there?
That's a very good question. I think it's worthwhile remembering the situation in the years leading up to that crisis. This is why economics and finance are so filled with human nature and human foibles. People forget that in 2004 and 5, the years leading up to the financial crisis, housing prices in the United States had been increasing relentlessly every year for 40 years, 35 or 40 years. And it was very easy for the market for mortgages to begin to assume that perhaps nationally anyway, that average housing prices would just continue to go up. Why wouldn't they? I mean, 30 by economic standards, 30, 35 years worth of data is pretty good. But of course, the minute you start assuming something in finance and economics, you often undermine it. So what happened was the mortgage people in charge of making mortgages decided to liberalize the terms largely. Using the fact that, well, since housing prices very seldom or hardly ever go down, we can justify writing mortgages that would have been considered very risky 50 or 60 years ago. You know, the 30-year zero down, no documentation option ARM was a product that our grandfathers would never have approved of. But if you start assuming that housing prices will always go up, why then, in the worst case scenario, you can always if the mortgagee doesn't make the payments, you can always repossess the house and sell it for, you know, roughly what you lent against it. And but of course, by doing that, by liberalizing the terms and in some cases ignoring the fact that some of your mortgage applications are potentially fraudulent, you can create a situation where housing becomes overvalued, and then you set in motion the possibility that housing will then go down, that housing prices will go down. And they went down in large part because the terms of the mortgages were just simply too liberal, and the housing market could not stand much of a correction. And when it began to correct, it snowballed. And as we all know, housing prices went down in certain areas of the countries by 30, 40, and 50%. And it's another case where human nature got in the way of finance.
Because you've been writing for decades on the topics that you cover, have you ever received any fan mail or critique or insights from the financial elite?
Well, I wouldn't say not from the elites. Although I tell you, I've been writing for a magazine called Financial History for years, and the editorial board, it has some of the, you know, the really top people in the field, and they like and very much enjoy some of the articles I've put together for them, and some of them have been very complimentary. Some of my articles have caused other of the writers for the magazine to become interested in this in a particular subject, and they have gone on to write articles that were in some sense stimulated by the some of my writings. So that's been very encouraging. I enjoy that.
In your professional opinion, if there were any recommendations or changes you propose for Wall Street, what would it be?
Well, I don't know. I think what we have to understand about Wall Street, and I don't know that I would run out and write a rule to try to correct it, but Wall Street is very trend dependent. Wall Street is filled with ambitious people always looking for the next new thing that is going to make them money, not only in the business of issuing securities, which is quite a lucrative business, but in the business of new product introduction and so on. They're always optimists, and that optimism can sow the seeds of disaster. But on the other hand, if you were to try to retard that, if you were try to dampen down this and create a bunch of regulations that would reduce the incentives, the people involved would be less ambitious. They would be less. They would not be looking for the next new thing. And that ability, that sense that Wall Street has of always looking for the next new thing, is quite a healthy thing for the economy generally, because you always want your capital to be the country's capital to be channeled as much as possible into new and exciting and potentially lucrative operations, and that's a healthy thing. Although in the you can always chronicle the mistakes that they've made, but on the other hand, their ambition is usually in the right place.
You've been writing for a long period of time. How has your writing evolved from when you started out to where you stand today?
Well, I think I'm much more interested in looking at the historical development of our capital markets and in some of the interesting characters that help shape the world, the financial world that we live in. I'm currently fascinated by the early trading companies, the Dutch and English East India companies that took these outlandish risks in sending their ships to the far corners of the earth at great risk to import new and exotic foods and spices into Europe. That would not have been possible using bank loans or more conventional methods of financing, for the simple reason that the risks were so great and the payoff was years after the money would have been borrowed. So the idea of creating a joint stock company is easy to ridicule now, all these years later, because some of these companies have done things that are, with the advantage of hindsight, we can all question. But the interesting thing that it did for humanity was to get organize some amount of capital to be patient and to try things that were risky and outlandish and in the short term, but that had the potential for improving people's lives in the longer term. And you see this all the time, that some of these huge capital projects, electrification, mass electrification, was a huge gamble. I write about it in the book, that some of the advances that had to be made in order to pull it off required patient capital. And that's an important thing to keep in mind.
You touch upon patient capital, and I think it makes a good point because I was going to ask you if you feel that the past historical traders and investors had more faith in the future to retrieve their return on investment compared to how short-sighted people can be in today's age, where they're tracking the markets around the clock and letting that dictate their emotions and their judgments.
Yes, potentially. It's hard to know it is fair to say that there's more trading now being done. Some of it is being done using advanced computer technology to try and get a little ahead of the trends. But I do think if you look at those stocks that dominate the discussion today on Wall Street, it's very much focused on the future. The people investing in Nvidia today, this new company that makes the chips for artificial intelligence. Although there's daily trading activity and everybody's all nervous about what every new day's trading will bring, the fact that Nvidia is capitalized, or was, say, 2 years ago, at tremendous multiples of its sales and profits, because people were optimistic about their prospects, say, 2, 3, and 5 years into the future. That starts to look a lot like, those old Dutch investors from the year 1600 who plopped down money to finance ships, knowing that it was going to take a couple of years for the capital that they had laid out to potentially pay off. So although things, the old adage, the more things change, the more they stay the same, is probably true that it's very much on a daily basis. You can be all distracted by all of the noise of the daily trading activity, but what's being done, what is attempted by the people doing the trading, is anticipating the future and trying to figure out what the next new thing might be.
In your book, Fiscal Follies, there is a chapter called The Banker Gets a Makeover. What is the makeover?
Oh, well, what I was trying to capture there was how in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, if you remember, the banker is portrayed by a wizened old man played by Lionel Barrymore, who's a kind of a miserable old codger who doesn't want to lend money to anybody because he doesn't think the citizens in his hometown are good credit risks. And that movie and the character, the caricature, the characterization of bankers being done in the 1940s when the movie was made, that worldview was slowly being changed. And the banker nowadays is a much more, well, certainly younger, better looking, and also potentially more generous with their lending than old man Potter was in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, if you recall. In other words, the what I tried to do is just show the extent to which although banking has changed, and banking is now done really looking to try to encourage the customers to come in and borrow money for any plans they might have. And so in a way, the banker is a less imposing and less an ugly figure as the banker was portrayed in that 1946 movie.
As much as there is many economic and financial resources for people to educate themselves, at the same rate, there's a lot of mismanagement and poor decisions being made. Where does that accountability lie with the financial institutions who should do better assessing of who they're going to do business with, or the civilian who is signing these papers and making a deal with possibly the devil?
Right. It's hard to know how to make that how to make that balance those equity. Certainly what has happened historically is that more and more of that responsibility has been placed on the banker. The banking is a very regulated business nowadays, even though, like I said, that there have been instances when everybody is an all in agreement about something, like that housing is bound to go up. Mistakes have been made, but the mistakes, it might be said, could resided on both sides. But it's possible, it's much easier to try to control the business through regulating the banker side of the transaction. And the bankers are in possession of more and better information than their average customer or their average client. That is certainly the case.
You are also a freelance writer. How has that landscape evolved compared to where people are? Some people are more optimistic about that field of work. Other people are a little bit more guarded due to AI. Where do you stand in amidst all of that?
Oh, and the role of a freelance writer?
Yes.
Well, it's certainly very difficult as a business, I would say. There aren't nearly the number of magazines and so on, paying magazines, that are interested in publishing work, freelance work. I am unsure exactly how AI will fit into this. The sub couple of things that I've read that have been AI generated haven't been particularly good, and in the sense that they summarize a particular amount of information, but they seldom do it in a way that's really interesting and provocative. And one of the advantages of being a writer like I am in this field of economic and finance economics and finance, looking at the field from as an outsider, is I can nearly always figure out a way something to say something that's a little different, combining facts about technology with facts about finance and economics is not the kind of thing that's easy to do. And so I'm optimistic that it might stimulate in the freelance writing community the drive to try to say something new and different.
I like how you point out the opportunity because from some of the samples that I've seen, they're very mild or bland in my
Yes, bland.
estimation. And for those who read a lot or they might be subject matter experts, you could pick out the content, which is that just stares back at you that you know it's not correct and it's aggregating content already created by other people. So you don't know whether it's a credible source or not.
I agree with you completely. When I am a expert on a particular subject matter, I actually had this experience very recently, and I was typing in some historical figure, and I realized that AI was going to summarize the person's life, and it was just wrong. They used his, perhaps matched up his name with somebody else, but they had some of his biographical details were just glaringly wrong. And maybe if you don't know any better, you might say, okay, this is a decent summary, but it's not. It's not a good summary. The AI has somehow combined source material and created error.
Touching upon writing productivity, do you have one writing tip, Daniel, that you discovered or you were taught that has improved your writing regimen?
I think my writing has been influenced quite a bit by reading. I read a lot of nonfiction, but I also read a lot of what you might call highbrow fiction. People like Thomas Mann and Dostoevsky and Jane Austen, and you can see in their writing, even light even humor writing like that of P.G. Woodhouse or something, you can see how skilled they are in shaping their paragraphs and their ideas. And you don't really learn how to do the particular writing that you're interested in doing, but you realize that there are a number of ways to write a paragraph, and there are only one or two ways that are really good, and there's a lot of ways that aren't as good. So once you what you do is you try to see and recognize the quality of some of the writing that you can encounter by reading works that are considered great literature. I think you can really learn quite a bit from great literature, and a lot of the stuff that's published nowadays is boilerplate. It's not that good, and it's they're doing murder mysteries or something like that, and it's very programmed and not nearly as good as it could be.
There are some writing teachers who tell their students, learn the rules of writing and then break them. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a pretty good way to think of it, in that you want to learn a few rules, but you also want to test the limits. You also want to try something a little different. It won't always work, but that drive to try to tell the story in a different way that maybe grabs the reader's attention a little bit more successfully and holds it. That's really the fun of it. That to me, that is the that's the art. If there is art in writing, that's the great outlet for creativity.
Would you say that is along the lines of show me, don't tell me?
Yes, very much, very much. I think that's a good way to summarize it. Try stuff. Try it. Try writing the paragraph a different way.
And what do you do to keep your writing fun on your day-to-day basis? Do you write every day? Do you write when you need to? How does it work in your life?
Well, I like to just keep reading until I happen across a subject or a situation that I think deserves more study. That, hey, this might be more interesting than it looks at first. Or what happened? I wrote an article recently about the tremendous rise and collapse in sugar prices in 1920, which was mentioned in a famous book on investing. And I thought, well, wait a minute. What ha I want to know what happened. How could the price increase 10x and then collapse by 90, 95% in the span of 5 years? And in doing so, I discovered there was all kinds of fascinating goings on that occurred to both produce the spike upwards and then to create the situation where the price collapsed. It's a small thing, but you would be for nonfiction writers, that's the fun part, is finding some situation that bears more scrutiny and then discovering that there are all kinds of sources that can illuminate that situation and show it in all of its colorful nature.
And as we start to wrap things up, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word?
Yes.
Oh, I don't.
Whether you speak it or you write it.
I can't. Nothing really comes to mind. I do like to maybe a word like enthusiasm, where it summarizes the bullish nature of someone who's just about to make a glaring financial mistake because he's just too enthusiastic about something coming to pass, or the I don't know, maybe a word like that.
Okay, no, that makes perfect sense given the nature of what you write on. And sometimes people let their emotions get in the way of making judgments. So.
Oh, yes. I'm afraid human nature is always going to be a little bit of a problem. Our tendency to in both cases to become too excited or enthusiastic, and then to in many cases to become too depressed or too discouraged. Oftentimes the best investing opportunities are it's when everybody else is discouraged. This is just a fact of financial life.
And Daniel, do you have any new upcoming work that the audiences should keep an eye out on?
Yes, I have an article coming out in the fall issue of Financial History Magazine about a guy named Leonard Jerome. And everybody's forgotten Leonard Jerome, but he was quite a figure in the 1860s and 70s New York. And he's now known to history largely as Winston Churchill's grandfather, but he was way more interesting than that in his own right. A very colorful and in many ways, very laudable man who had great accomplishments, but is now recognized merely as Winston Churchill's American grandfather.
Wow. Okay, we'll have to look that one up. Please let the audiences know where they could reach you.
Well, I am on my books are on Amazon, and those folks interested in reaching out can talk to the publisher of the book Fiscal Follies, and they have been getting in touch with me. Some of my readers have quite enjoyed the Fiscal Follies and have reached me through my publisher, Defiance Press, specifically Keynote Books, the imprint, and Defiance Press.
Any final words, Daniel?
No, I've enjoyed this conversation, and I enjoy talking about the book Fiscal Follies, as well as the writing process and the position that writers find themselves in the year 2025.
Thank you for casting a colorful light on economics and financial theories out there, Daniel. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.